gives me great pleasure to introduce Danny Dorling from the University of Oxford, who is going to talk to us, as you can see, about what Brexit has done to the British. So I hope you've got your notebooks out and you're changing places, heads on. Lots to do. Okay, thanks, Danny.
Thanks ever so much. Thanks for giving up a little bit of your afternoon. I'm going to talk at you for just over half an hour. Then you get to ask questions. If anybody really wants to ask a question as we're going along, that's perfectly fine. Don't hold it in if you're desperate to say something. This is a talk that's partly about a book. The book's called Rule Britannia. Me and my friend Sally began writing it before the referendum. And then we carried on writing it. We had to keep on changing it. It gets published on the 15th of January next year, probably a week before the MPs will actually get to vote. That legislation, if you don't know about it, and it's very likely you don't, was put into place over a year ago, so we had a fairly good idea about what was going to happen. Brexit's really, really interesting. How many of you are completely bored of it? Put your hands up. Quite a few, yeah. How many of you still find it interesting? Minority. I'm going to try and convince you it's more interesting than you think. For you, this is mostly what you've known through your key teenage years. So you're in no position to know whether it's interesting or not. But it's a lot more exciting than what happened when I was your age, which was in the 1980s. Not much happened in 1983, 84, 85, 86 when I was the same age as you. We were worried that we were going to die in a nuclear war, but luckily we didn't. But other than that, things carried on much the same. We had a Conservative government, we had 3 million people unemployed. The Conservatives won election after election after election. They were all powerful. You're seeing something utterly different. You're watching the leading political party of Britain fighting itself in a way it hasn't fought itself inside itself since the Corn Laws. You're in a country that's got no idea what's going to happen between now and the 29th of March. There is a lot going on. That's what I said I was going to talk about. I always put up what I said I'm going to talk about to try to make me talk about it. That's the only thing you're going to have to read, and you don't have to read it, but to give you an idea of the context of all of this. What Sally and I came to the conclusion when we're trying to understand what Brexit was about is it has an awful lot to do with the British Empire and the fact that this country had the largest empire the world has ever known and held it just over 100 years ago. So when you're looking at people's attitudes and opinions in Britain, particularly old people, what you've got to remember is that they were brought up in a country which had been the richest country in the world, that they were taught at their schools various things about that country, about how it was superior, about how it should be the richest place. When I did geography at school, I was taught how to get tin and rubber, where you should go to get it. That was in my A-level syllabus. I was taught how a large river works, and the reason I would need to know how a large river works would be if I was ever in charge of a large country as a colonial officer. The A-level syllabus took some time to develop. Now, by the 1980s, when I was doing A-level geography, we only had Hong Kong, and it doesn't have a large river. And you're no longer taught that kind of geography. But if you imagine that you're growing up in Britain back in the 1940s, or 50s, or 60s, then you were taught things at school which are very different to what you're taught now. And if you're trying to understand people's attitudes, you have to go back to that. I picked something out. This is a magazine that was published last week. And the reason for picking it out, I think he was here. Is it Lee? The bloke who did the Peterloo Massacre movie. Might have been. I'm not sure if he's at the school. Anyway, he said he did the movie. It's coming out this year. Because he hadn't been taught about the Peterloo Massacre at school. So I thought I'm going to tell you about the British Empire a bit, because we don't tend to teach very much about it. I'll put up a picture in a minute for that. First of all, something about inequality. We're not the first country to try to leave the European Union. There's one other country which did try to leave and succeeded in leaving the European community. Does anybody know what it was? The name of that country? Let's check. Any guesses? Shall I?
Greenland.
Where?
Greenland.
Greenland, spot on. Yeah, it's Greenland, it's Greenland. Greenland left some time ago. The reasons for Greenland leaving?
Is Greenland really a country that's part of the Kingdom of Denmark?
It's connected to Denmark, but it is formally independent. But it's useful it's connected to Denmark, because Greenland spent 3 years negotiating leaving, and although Greenland's left, they still have citizenship of Denmark, which means they can still come and go as they want. Greenland spent 3 years negotiating, I think, because they had a lot of fish, and those fish are actually worth quite a lot, and the European community were quite interested in the fish. We're still sending €500 for every child to Greenland to help their schools, which kind of gives you an idea about how much the fish are worth to European fisheries. What's going on with Britain is it's somewhat different. That little graph at the top is a graph of inequality. It's a graph of how much the top 10% of people make. Way back in 1920s and 30s, the top 10% were taking half of all income. Half of everything in Britain went every year to the best of 10. The other 90% of society were living on half. It was a very unequal country at a time when we were the heart of the British Empire. The most common job for the girls in this room, the most likely thing you would have gone on to do then, would be to work in service, to actually be a maid servant in a house and do somebody else's cooking and cleaning. The most common jobs for men were mining, manufacturing, possibly textiles, that kind of thing. The country became progressively more and more equal. The divide between the people who had servants and the people who were servants disappeared. By the 1960s and 70s, almost nobody had a servant anymore in the country. Most people were relatively well off. We had full employment. But then from 1979 onwards, that red line goes up, and we're now back at the best off 10% taking 40% of everything. Not quite half, but leaving 60% to the bottom 90%, if you get an idea of the difference. Now, why does that matter, or why may it matter? If you're trying to look for ways in which Britain is different from the other 28 European Union countries, one key way in which we're different is that we're the most economically unequal. The other way in which we're different is that we used to have an empire. And it's in retrospect that we begin to put these things together to try to work out what is happening. There are about 40 or 50 OECD countries. OECD countries are the richest countries in the world. About a quarter of all countries are in the OECD. This is a list of the most unequal OECD countries. The most unequal is Mexico, then Chile, then Turkey, which currently has political problems. It's run by a man who doesn't want to give up power. His picture is all over Istanbul, if you have a go. Then by the United States, which is also run by a man who at least wants to hold on to power at the next election, although his picture isn't all over America. Then, I'm being slightly disingenuous, Lithuania, which is in Europe, goes high, but it's a tiny country and it jumps out of that league table every other year. Then Russia. Russia's a very unequal country. Russia, after 1989, a few people managed to grab hold of most of the resources, and within 10 years, Russia got the kind of inequality that it had taken the British people 1,000 years to build up from 1066. And right next to Russia is us. We are almost as unequal as Russia. So if you're ever looking at Russia and looking at the fact there are rich Russians but most Russians are poor, in a way you're looking at Britain. But because we're used to Britain, and think of it as normal, we don't tend to think of our society like this. But if you go to expensive parts of London, apart from the fact you'll meet some Russians there, you will meet people who never have to work, who have a wealth of the minimum of 2.5 million, may have five, may have 10, never need to do a job. And we have a sizable number of those people. And we have lots of other people who will work on two or three jobs a week and never get out of poverty. And that's unusual. We have the biggest, greatest number of people in poverty in Western Europe. After us, the next most unequal country in the OECD is Israel. But Israel is slightly more equal than we are. And that's Israel including the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So if you watch the news at all and you see what's going on in Israel and you see people's attitudes to each other, you've got to remember we're slightly more unequal than them. We don't have soldiers shooting people through fences, but we do have the same kind of gaps between rich and poor that you get in Israel. And the reason for telling you all this is to try to give you some background, to try to work out why Britain. Why are we, after Greenland, the first country to try to leave the European Community? There's a picture of the Empire. It's drawn in a weird way. You're going to see more weird maps in a minute. It's drawn with countries the size of their current populations. So by far the largest part of the British Empire by population was India. You'd have to have good eyesight to see all of it. The world's biggest empire, the biggest empire there's ever been. The dates at which all the countries joined the empire are given there. None of them, as far as I know, chose to join. We didn't give them a choice. We have invaded more countries than any other country on earth. And the dates at which they left are given there. And in most cases, that freedom was won. There was insurrection, there was rioting, there was often armed struggle. We don't teach this fully. We touch on it now a little bit in history curriculum in schools, but we really don't go into the full detail. Partly because if we did, our entire history A-level would just be about empire, because there's so much to say. Just to give you an example about the global scale of this thing, you may get taught about the end of the slave trade, but you're rarely ever taught about the beginnings of it. And of course that was British. We took people from one continent, Africa, we shipped them over to another, America, we made them pick cotton by hand. The cotton then goes back across the Atlantic to places like Manchester. Then the British weave the cotton, and then the cotton is sent on ships down to India, whose textile industry is destroyed by the British invaders, and they're made to buy the cotton that we produce. That isn't a story that we still don't teach that. What we taught in the past was how wonderful we were. We taught young people how we invented everything. The steam engine, the spinning jenny, almost everything. The history O-level, I'm so old I did an O-level, not GCSE. The history O-level I did was all about memorising the names of men, Arkwright and whatever, and what they invented at particular dates. Now if you go over to Paris, and you go to the Industrial Museum in Paris, you'll find a different set of people who invented everything. Because things don't actually get invented by one person. What happens is a particular loom gets developed, people come and have a look, they change it somewhere else, have a sneaky look at a loom over in somewhere like Berlin, and they take the methods back. Right? We didn't invent everything. But it was a useful kind of myth to tell ourselves that we invented everything and we're best at making everything in the world. What we actually did is force people to buy the things that we made and to give us the raw material to put it together. And the extent of the empire doesn't just stop there. That's a kind of formal empire. But the other kind of things that we did, which are worth knowing about, and if it hadn't been us, by the way, it would have been another European country. So don't suddenly start feeling too guilty, and it certainly wasn't you. It was just your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, and it probably wasn't them, because they were working in a mill for somebody else who decided what they did. But the other kind of things that we did is that when we didn't actually control China, it wasn't part of our empire, we controlled Hong Kong, but we wanted money from China. We found something the Chinese wanted, and we grew it in India. It was opium. And when we grew the opium in India, and we took it in ships to China, the Chinese said they didn't want it. So we sent battleships, because free trade is really important, and we forced the Chinese to buy our opium. And civilization collapsed in China. Right, it's a hell of a legacy, but I'm telling you a different story to the traditional British story. The traditional British story has been told all the way through my life. This was a picture from 1997. This man is the Chancellor of my university, Chris Patton. He was the last governor of Hong Kong. And the pictures that were shown when Hong Kong stopped being a colony were of his daughter crying. And the sort of implicit story was she was crying as the last British flag goes down on the last part of the empire, and it's ever so sad. What you can't see there is Prince Charles looking a bit gormless at the side. Prince Charles has never known what to do if a woman starts crying. But anyway, that's pictures in the book. The reason she was crying wasn't because Britain was no longer going to hold on to Hong Kong, because she's been asked years later, why were you crying? She actually cried for 3 hours. She was crying continuously for the whole thing. And she was crying because she had to leave Alex, who was her boyfriend, right? But we painted the picture differently. That's just a kind of little sum up about the British Empire. I'm trying to throw various things into the mix about what's going on now. How many of you have been to France? Your hands up? Okay. And how many euros can you get for a pound, roughly? About 189 pence, okay. I went at 15 with my school to France on my first ever school trip, first trip abroad. And I'm not that ancient. This was 35 years ago, so long enough. When I went to France, you got 10 francs, which is equivalent of a euro, for a pound. And you could buy a bottle of wine for 3 francs. So imagine £1 buys you 3 bottles of wine and you're 15 years old. Right? So, and it's not just me. Anybody in Britain who could go over to France back then, you could live a life of a king for 2 weeks on a summer holiday. We were really rich. And that isn't that long ago. If I go back further, when my granddad was a child, which was in the, just before the 1920s, you could get $5 a pound. When my mum was a child, you could get 4. When I was born, you could get 3. When my oldest child was born, you got 2. And now we're rapidly heading to $1 to the pound. It's a remarkable change in the country. We've gone from being very, very rich to becoming remarkably normal. But we're not kind of ready to be normal. There's an idea we should be bigger than this. And then the other thing, the third factor after empire and inequality, is immigration. When you look at opinion polls for the last 20, 25 years, people in Britain have worried about immigration. I'd argue they've been told to be worried about immigration, but here's a graph that goes from 1841. 1841 was the first census in which we asked people, where were you born, through to 2011, which is the last census. And it's showing the number of people in millions, up to 8 million, who are living in Britain and born abroad. The first big proportions of immigrants here were from Ireland. There was a famine in Ireland. It was a famine partly because Ireland was an English colony and we didn't really worry about the fact there was a famine in Ireland. And then we have a little bump, 1901 to 1905, immigration from Eastern Europe, which a minority was Jewish. At that time there were lots of scares about this immigration. What's going to happen if you let these immigrants in? An organisation called the British Union of Fascists was formed to stop immigration because it was going to be terrible if these Jewish people came into the country. You then get a little bit of a dip and then a rise again, and the acceleration point is the Windrush generation, which was when politicians like Enoch Powell went out to the Caribbean and asked people to come to Britain to do jobs like nursing. And because we went out and asked people, they came. We partly wanted people to work the night shifts. British people, people born in Britain, were becoming unwilling in manufacturing plants to work at night on the night shift. But also we didn't have enough people. Because in the 1930s, there was a slump in babies. People had fewer babies. So by the time you get to the 1960s, you haven't got enough labour. And then you have the most recent rise, which is the rise from Eastern Europe, which happened when Britain was one of the few countries that allowed people from Eastern Europe in first before the other countries did. But again, it fitted a slump. The slump in this case was the 1970s. The number of babies born in the 1970s was much less than two a couple. And so 30 years later, you don't actually have enough people. And we get the increase. Now that can look dramatic like that. But if I show you the same graph with people born in Britain on it, it looks tiny. And if I show you the same graph for other countries, it looks very similar, if not even more immigration in most other countries. And the other thing to say before I move on from this one is that what I'm not showing you is all the people who left. And up here, if you took all the people who left and we put them down here, we were an emigrant nation. We were sending huge numbers of people out to the empire. More people actually left than have come in over the last 160 years. But we never think of the people who leave as immigrants. We call them expats. Here's one of these weird maps. So this is Europe. The map is stretched so that every area is the size of the number of people who live there. So you're looking at the cities. If there's a mountainous area where nobody lives, we just shrunk it away. Because you need to worry about where people live. And the map's shaded by the proportion of people, this colour here, the dark blue, means that more than a fifth of people were born in another country. The very lightest, kind of green colour, or actually there, yellow colour, less than 5%. This is Eastern Europe. Most of Eastern Europe, less than 5% of people are immigrants. You get some people coming in from further east, Russia, but generally not many. That's Warsaw. This is the north of England. Most of the north of England is that same shade of yellow. Less than 5% of people are immigrants. There are remarkably few immigrants in most of Britain. The area with the highest proportion of immigrants, there, that's part of Inner West London. It's the only part of England which gets over 20% of people born abroad, is Inner West London. This is Ireland. And the reason why Ireland's coloured darker is if you're born in the Republic and you move to Belfast, you're an immigrant. And if you're born in Belfast and you move down to Dublin, you're an immigrant. And also quite a few people came in to Ireland. But the UK, apart from Northern Ireland and in Middle London, is not a country full of immigrants. And it isn't because the data's wrong, it really isn't. If you want a country that's got high rates of immigrants, this one here, which is Switzerland, has a much higher rate. But that's partly just the shape of Switzerland. It has mountains in the middle, it's long and thin, it's right next to Germany and Italy and France. You go up 20 miles south, you go and work in Switzerland, you're an immigrant. This is Paris, which is slightly less. This is a really interesting area. This is Spain. That's Madrid, that's Barcelona. This is the Costa del Sol. So if you want a large area of Europe which has had a large amount of immigration, it's Spain that you need to look at. And although there are people from many places and quite a few from Africa there, they're not the biggest group of immigrants. The biggest group of immigrants in Spain grew up here. But they decided they didn't want to retire around here. So they got on the plane and they've retired down there. And the interesting thing about them is you're probably going to meet some of them soon, because if they fall ill after the 29th of March, they won't be able to go to hospital there anymore. So they're going to start coming back. We have a really weird deal with Europe. We export about 1 million of our old people to Crete and Cyprus and Spain and Greece and France, loads in France. And they tend to spend the rest of their years there. And they use local health service. At the same time, we import a couple of million people who we haven't paid for their schooling or anything else, or they go to university. Another country pays for all of that. they come here and generally do fairly lowly paid work very well while living in very cramped conditions. That's our kind of demographic deal. No other country in Europe has that deal. Switzerland comes nearest. Switzerland could operate without the immigrants. But that's our deal. We send our elderly abroad, the more affluent elderly. David Cameron's dad, Nick Clegg's dad, they both died in France. And we take in young, enthusiastic, fairly fit, well-educated young people who do jobs here. A third of midwives in London are EU citizens, but not UK citizens. And the interesting thing, one of the many interesting things about Brexit, is we're going to find out to what extent immigration matters, because already 700,000 people haven't come. A couple of graphs for you. So I'm just trying to give you pieces of evidence, layering them up one after another. This weird little graph here, this one, is the support since 1997 for far-right parties in the UK. Far-right in this case meaning to the right of the Conservative Party. So the Referendum Party, the BNP, UKIP, are all there. Way back in 1997, the Referendum Party gets about 2% of the vote. It was a party funded by James Goldsmith. He sent everybody in Britain got a VHS cassette. Who knows what a VHS video cassette is? Great, well done, okay. Yeah, they were all sent one, telling them how terrible Europe was. Anyway, get about 2% of the vote. Then the vote for UKIP gets up a bit higher in 2004, but then it collapses again. Then it jumps up again in 2009, and then collapses again. 2004, 2009 were European elections. Then it goes really, really, really fast. It goes right up to here, about a quarter of all votes in the European election of 2014, and then collapses again. UKIP are currently down here. So the point of showing you this graph is to say there hasn't been a steady rise in people supporting parties who really, really disliked Europe. For some reason, just before key elections, people in Britain suddenly say, we don't like Europe. And the day after the election, when you ask them what they care about, they've forgotten. So I'll leave that to you to try to work out how that happens. The little pie charts there, if you're very nerdy about this, the pie charts are different. The blue area of the pie charts is a different definition of far right. Suppose we take the European definition of far right. So you're a far right political party if you're to the right of European Conservatives. And there's a big group in the European Parliament, I think called the EPP, the European People Party, which is the mainstream European Conservative Party. Around about 2009, our Conservative Party left that group. In 2014, it has formed its own group in Europe to the right of mainstream Conservatives. And in 2014, in European elections, I think it's 51.9% of people in Britain voted UKIP, or Conservative, or DUP, or another party to the right of mainstream European Conservatives. So what I'm trying to tell you is, if you were sitting in the mainland of Europe and you're looking at British politics, you would have said, oh, the majority of people in Britain have voted for a far-right party. Nobody at the time said that. In hindsight, it's very interesting. Nobody at the time said it. One thing that happens on the 29th of March, if we leave, is that the largest block of far-right members of the European Party are suddenly out of a job. Our Conservatives are allied with the Free Finns, with Alternative for Deutschland, which are the neo-Nazis in Germany and so on. But the only way that all the tiny far-right parties on the mainland can work together in European Parliament is with our MEPs. And without them, the far-right in the mainland of Europe partly collapses. So if you're wondering why France and Germany and Italy aren't that bothered about us leaving, that might help partly explain it. They're ever so polite. There's a game going on in Europe at the moment about not being the first head of a European country to tell the British what's going on. The president of Latvia almost failed at this recently, but he managed to be quiet again. And it's interesting. This graph here is the voting by age. None of you will have voted in the referendum, 23rd of June 2016. So the voting by age, this is the youngest, 18 to 24 year olds. How many of you are 18 or almost 18? A few of you, put your hands up. You might get a vote, we don't know, we can talk about it in the next few months. Anyway, the key thing is if you're 18 or 24, don't be part of that big blue group. They were the ones who didn't bother to vote. Right, the large majority of 18 to 24 year olds didn't vote. The reason is because 18 to 24 year olds never vote. Or at least since 1991 they haven't voted. But those who did vote, most of them voted remain. Small group voted leave. Here's the 25 to 34s. And you'll see more of them bother to vote. And they mostly vote remain. Bigger group voting leave. Middle age, 35 to 44. Almost split. That's remain, that's leave. Minority don't vote. My old age group, I'm in an age group which means that most people of my age in Britain voted leave. The blue bar is smaller than the red bar. And then we get the oldies. I'll call these middle-aged soon when I get into that category. But anyway, there you see big red group, very low numbers of old people not voting. Old people were really crucial to this vote. They voted leave and they bothered to turn up. They had nothing else to do, particularly when they were tired. And that little graph there is the dollar to the pound over time. So what I'm trying to say to you, now, why did old people vote to leave? We can't know why anybody voted to leave or remain. We can do surveys, we can guess, we can't know. The only thing we can know is geography. So I'm going to show you the geography next. I don't think they voted leave because they're selfish at all. I think they voted leave for their grandchildren. And they voted leave for those who did because they're worried that grandchildren won't be able to afford a house, won't get a job that pays enough, they're worried about the schools, and so on. When you look at people, that's what they say. But also, they can remember that relatively things were much better. They were on top of the world when they were your age. And they kind of want that back again for you. Whereas the younger you are, the less likely you are to sort of think, we should be the number one nation. And also, maybe the more magnanimous you might be. Okay, here's the first map of the vote. The map was fascinating. This is the United Kingdom, shaded just blue or yellow. The blue is areas which were majority leave, the yellow is majority remain. Scotland, remain. Partly because Scotland, the big problem was London. The enemy of Scotland has always been, at least for my lifetime, London, not Brussels. London was the core support for remain. Northern Ireland was split, there's actually majority remain. And this is the same map I shaded by how much people voted. Middle of London was really, really remain. Some parts of Scotland, Edinburgh and Glasgow, very, very remain. Most of Britain is light blue. Only just leave. Marginally leave. A few areas are stronger blue. And I'm now going to, if you're bored, the next 5 minutes are going to be really boring. Just warning you, okay? Because I'm going to show you some maps that I haven't shown before, so it's exciting for me. The geography is the one thing we can be sure about. Because we know for each area how many people voted leave, remain, and didn't vote. We don't know why they did it, but we know who did. And the one thing the press have got most wrong in Britain in reporting the vote is describing the geography of it. And again, it's interesting to think, why have they done this? I think it's partly because on the night the press was shocked. The press and almost everybody else expected a Remain win. The markets expected a Remain win. The people who bet money, the spread bettors expected to remain win. And the spread bettors had got every election right, so it was the first thing they got wrong. More people voted leave here in Essex, so that's a little bit here, just next to London, than all of these areas put together. And those areas have got a bigger electorate. More people voted leave in Hampshire, which is down here, than in Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke, and Sunderland put together. and there were more electors in all those areas. The image you'll have seen on the night is a blonde woman and two of her mates with no hair at Sunderland celebrating. That was the image of the night that was shown. And hence Sunderland becomes associated with Leith. Nobody's ever said it was Hampshire. Kent, more people vote Leith in Kent than Derby, Blackpool, Rotherham, Sheffield, which voted Leith, all these areas voted Leith, Great Yarmouth, Hartlepool, Merthyr in Wales. Here's the really boring bit. Oh no, not yet. I'll skip that one. Oh no, I'll tell you this one. Correlations, if you do correlations. The weakest correlation with Leith vote is deprivation. 0.03, it's no correlation between being poor and voting Leith nationally. 0.03. The strongest correlation of 0.8 is with obesity. And the academic who published this was absolutely pilloried. He published it 3 weeks after the vote. He just typed in the numbers, put all the correlations in, they got this 0.8 correlation. Obesity basically means this. So I feel like I haven't actually got to this weight just so that I can talk about obesity without feeling bad to people who are obese. But essentially, if you're my weight and a bit more, I'm afraid you're just tipping over. Why do we get the strongest correlation with obesity? It isn't, as that academic tried to guess, because people who are fat are feckless and lazy. The reason, almost certainly, is immigration. Because the next strongest correlation with the Leave vote is immigration. It's 0.79, so it's almost the same. Areas with high numbers of immigrants tend to be thinner. Remember me telling you that immigrants tended to be young, fit, well-educated? They also tend to be annoyingly thin. And the areas with large number of immigrants are thinner, and not only the immigrants thinner, local people eat less. Because if you've got loads of thin people around you, it makes you feel fat. I've managed to avoid this in Oxford. I still eat a lot. If you're in an area where nobody ever comes, I don't know, let's pick on Hull, a few, you quietly get fatter together. And one of the reasons why we are, along with Hungary, the fattest nation in Europe, is because it's easier to get fat if everybody else gets fat. And it's easier to get thin if everybody else is fit. It's not just about self-will. If any of you ever want to feel really thin, go to the United States. If you want to feel really fat, go to Japan. There's a difference. Anyway, that's enough correlations. Okay, some weird maps, and then we'll bring this to a conclusion. So please take some questions. This is a zoomed-in picture, because this is where we are now on these strange maps. This is Dunedin and Bedworth. So if you've never seen a map like this before, you are stuck on the edge of this huge area called the West Midlands, with Coventry and Birmingham. And there's Leicester over there. And I suspect if you go, for those of you who go out and want to find a good nightclub, there may be some in Dunedin, but I suspect you're going there, or possibly there. This is one of these maps where we've made areas proportional to population. So that's where you are, forgetting about all the fields. So if you can memorise that, I'm going to go through about 10 of these other ones really quickly, and then we get one. This is Cornwall. 56% of people in Cornwall voted Leave, 183,000. In these areas, slightly higher voted Leave, but less, 181,000, and they had a bigger electorate. So more people in Cornwall vote Leave than Broxtow, Ashfield, Nottingham, and Gedling. Devon, you can begin to predict it. 377,000 people voted Leave in Devon. Here's a set of areas which you've got slightly more electors than Devon. Conway, Denbighshire, Flintshire at the top of Wales, Gateshead, County Durham, Eden, South Lakeland up in the north, produce fewer Leave voters, 372,000, despite more voters. That's Cornwall, that's Devon. There's Hampshire, which I told you about earlier, more Leave voters than an area with the same population in the north. And this shows you how sad academics are. I've gone around the whole country doing this for 26 southern counties. This is the Isle of Wight, 49,000 vote Leave, compared to Luton, just 47,000. Isle of Wight's got 127 sorry, the Isle of Wight has got 109,000 people on electoral roll. Luton has 127, but less people voted Leave in Luton, right? The vote was always bigger in the south than these comparable areas. Here's Kent, which I told you about before. There's Essex. Well, I didn't tell you about Kent, but let's skip it anyway. There's Essex. 622,000 people voting Leave in Essex. Here are some of the areas that I'm comparing Essex to, and here are all the rest. And more people in Essex voted Leave than all these places in the north, which include places like Redcar and Cleveland and Scarborough and Barrow, which are always used in TV documentaries about the referendum. West Midlands, 763, I put West Midlands in the south here, bigger than all these areas in the north. You are just there. Gloucestershire, more people voted Leave in Gloucestershire than those areas. Somerset was more of a centre of Leave voting than the combined voters of Darlington, Harrogate, Stockton-on-Tees, Hartlepool, Middlesbrough. Middlesbrough is a place they go to more than the others, Hamilton and York. I'm just trying to get it through to you, you know, and I'm slightly obsessed by this, that one day the British press will stop saying that this was a vote of poorer people in the north of England. Because it's very, very easy to show that the majority of Leave voters from the south, even somewhere like Bristol, which had 87,000 Leave voters, it's a Remain city. Edinburgh, bigger city, just 64,000. Wiltshire, more Leave voters in Wiltshire than the equivalent area in the north. Right, you'll be glad to know that's over, but we can't go on about it. One problem the press has is once it begins to tell a story, it finds it very hard to change the story. The other problem the press have is that they're based in West London and their parents live in the southeast of England. That's where they're going to be going home to at Christmas. And all those people you see to the BBC News, on Christmas Day, they'll be in Hampshire or Dorset or Kent with mum and dad. Mum and dad will be the age of your grandparents, and mum and dad, more often than not, will have voted Leave. And they're West London news people. This graph was produced by Standard & Poor, who are a financial firm, about 3 weeks before the vote, and it was a prediction of which countries are going to be most affected after the UK by Brexit. And it was remarkably accurate. Ireland was the most affected country, and after Ireland it was Malta, which is a tiny island, then Luxembourg, which is a tiny principality, then Cyprus, which is one of our ex-colonies, another island, Switzerland, which is not in the EU27, and then Belgium. This matters because these countries here, Germany, France, the big countries, are all the way down here. They're not affected by UK leaving, hardly at all. So when you come to negotiate, as our civil servants were doing all summer, it's really tricky. Because we're saying you need to give us this or that, and they're saying, why? What, you know, what are we going to lose if you go? They don't particularly like our banks. That's the biggest export, is being able to use British banks. But people tend not to like bankers, because what bankers do is they give you a service and they charge you quite a lot of money for it. Nobody tends to like the people who lend them money. Only 3 slides to go, so please do think of questions on anything. You're living in remarkable times. This little graph is all the general elections since 1945 to 2017. These are the swings. You might have been taught once about 1945 election. It was a massive landslide for Labour, 10.4% swing. Or the 1997 election, which was 8.8% swing to Labour, but that was after 18 years of Conservative rule. Tony Blair, his next election he got a minus 2.5 and then a minus 5.5 swing. Gordon Brown did even worse, got minus 6.2, but the world economy just collapsed. It's kind of understandable. Ed Miliband, got plus 1.4, which is really good compared to that. And then Jeremy Corbyn gets plus 9.6, which is unprecedented in 2 years. Never happened before. This little graph here is showing you how fast the rise was. You just have to believe me, it's the fastest, quickest rise in changes of voting ever in the 8 weeks before the election last year. And just a couple of reasons for showing this. What this means is that we've got absolutely no idea what's going to happen now. So it's quite exciting. In the past, we used to take the biggest changes that have happened before, and we'd say, well, whatever might happen, it won't be bigger than that. The reason why Theresa May called an election last year is that her officials told her, whatever happens, you can't actually end up losing control of the House of Commons, because that's never happened from your position, given where the opinion polls are now. That was the advice to Theresa May. Theresa May was a geography undergraduate in my department, and she kind of believes the advice she gets, and they were right, it was the correct advice to give her. And then amazingly, within a few weeks, she actually manages to turn a majority into a minority government and have to work with the DUP, which isn't going very well now. The other fascinating thing about this is that all these other times when Labour have done really well, they did quite badly afterwards, because they win and they come to power. And whenever you come to power, you really disappoint people, because you can't actually make the world wonderful in a couple of years. Right, then the fascinating thing now is you've had this enormous swing, mainly because young people voted. The best way to get young people to vote is to hold a referendum on the EU and decide you're going to leave. And then young people get very, very annoyed, and then they vote in an election. And people who didn't normally vote, voted. But the thing we don't know is what happens at the next election, given that Labour got this enormous swing but didn't win, so they haven't been in power, so nobody can say, you promised to do this, but you haven't done it. And that's why anything can happen. Only one more slide. We're not very good at protesting. And that might be connected back to the British Empire. These are the international statistics on how many adults. How many of you have been involved in a march, a demonstration? How many of you have gone on strike and said you're not going to school? Hey, you've got one. You've got a few of the adults. I have a friend called Demetrius Ballas. Demetrius is in his 40s. And if you were to ask a load of people in Greece of the age of some of your teachers, they would all put their hands up, because there's 3 months in Greece where all the children didn't go to school because there's a strike. We've never had a school strike, as far as I know, of any significance. The figures there are showing you that the second most boring people in Europe are the Germans. Only 30% of German adults have ever been on a demonstration or complained about things in that way. But for us, it's only 1 in 6. You know, you really can treat people in Britain quite badly and they won't complain about it very much. And that might be connected to an empire mentality. What you need to do, how you need to bring up a population, school them, to get them to be quite well behaved. The French are the best at it. The French will come out and demonstrate about anything, and it may not be unconnected to the fact that of all the large European countries, Germany, Italy, Spain, UK and France, France is actually the most equal. You wouldn't believe it listening to them. France has the cheapest, highest quality housing. France has the most, well, second best health service to Germany and so on. Germany spends £1 billion more a week on its health service than we do. Forget 350 million. If you want a German-style health service, you've got to spend £1 billion more a week. And France is almost there. Which may be why the Germans don't protest as much. Last image. You'll be familiar with that. The interesting thing about that is partly, I don't need to say anything about it, but partly the timing of what's gone on. The timing is an economic crash in 2008, the biggest recession we've had, bigger than 1929 recession, falling incomes in real terms year after year after year. A health service falling apart. Life expectancy in this country dropping since 2014. Infant mortality rising. A Brexit vote. Then an election, which didn't go the right way. And now no deal that can actually be agreed upon, with a clock ticking. A 585 page document, which only contains 115 words about the banks. And the banks are the thing that make the most money in Britain. And a law that says that a meaningful vote has to be held in the House of Commons by the 20th of January. No choice, that has to happen by law. The MPs can all get together and vote to delay by 5 days. Then they have to get together and vote again to delay by 5 days. And again by 5 days. If you're interested in what's going to happen, look up the clip by the man who runs the Road Haulage Association, how he describes that the average 20-foot lorry contains 8,000 items, each of which will need to have documentation if we do a hard Brexit on the 29th of March. My personal view is that we can't actually do it. We gave people a choice back in 2016 between carrying on with David Cameron, life as it is, all a bit crap, has got worse, that was one choice, that was vote Remain, or unicorn, that was leave. It was just everything will get better. And if you're given a choice between Remain and a unicorn, and where you are is bad, you vote for the unicorn. The people who voted Remain are in my city in Oxford, because they're doing well, in Cambridge, in the middle of London, and in Bristol, and in Manchester. But in most of the country, people voted for the unicorn. And the really, really difficult thing between now and the 29th of March is telling people, sorry, it's a unicorn. Now, you want to disagree with me. You know, you might say, surely we can do this. And there is a way in which, there is obviously a way in which we can. But it is quite difficult to do. The civil service are planning for it. They're planning for food dumps, medicines, all the rest of it. It's their job to do it. But just to give you one example, forget the average lorry with 8,000 items in it. If you happen to be running a civil nuclear facility, of which my university is a place that does, there's 65 documents about what to do in the event of a hard Brexit. One of them's for us. And at the end it says, you will receive funding until the end of 2019 for your civic nuclear facility, after which we suggest you seek professional help. Now, professional help means working out the redundancy payment, but also the right kind of concrete to put over the reactor. Nobody's bothered with that, reading that document, because most of you don't own a nuclear reactor. But if you're interested in medicines, if you're interested in aeroplanes, if you're interested in food, because the potato harvest failed in this country last year because the temperatures are too high, it's going to be very tricky. And there's currently an argument, the biggest argument that the Conservative Party have had within itself since the Corn Laws, within a party where some people believe it's possible and most members of the Conservative Party don't and want a deal. And then there are loads of other MPs who want to remain and want no deal. And I cannot tell you what's going to happen. I just don't think we are going to leave on a hard Brexit on the 29th of March. But if you were the Prime Minister, and the only person who can do anything as a Prime Minister according to Article 50, if you're the Prime Minister, or a new Prime Minister elected by MPs, and you had to break it to the country that they've been offered a unicorn, the way to do it is to leave it to the very last minute as Project Fear turns into real fear. And at some point in March, you write a letter and you rescind Article 50. And even after then, if that happens, you're still going to have chaos. Because some people are going to be so very, very, very angry. Next year is not going to be boring. Now, if I was you, I would be quite interested in this. British people are very, very good at queuing, so it could be okay. And that last thought I'll give you, if we are planning in case there is a hard Brexit, there is an issue about food. But remember, along with Hungary, we're the fattest nation in Europe. So all we need is a rationing system, which involves Weight Watchers, where people like me will actually get a smaller ration than some of you. And within 1 year of Brexit, we could be the thinnest country in Europe. Thank you very much for your patience. Please think of a question. Thank you.